I like it. All right, Proverbs 25, 16 and 17. I have a sneaking suspicion that we've done this one before. But I don't know. I need a larger hard drive. 25, 16, and 17. What?
You're like, I don't know. And he goes, any others.
Just pick something. There's a lot of Proverbs. That looks good. That's good. Somebody explain that to me. 16 and 17. 25.
With patience, a ruler may be persuaded.
Keep going. I'm sorry. Did I say 15 and 16? 16 and 17.
No, he said 16 and 17.
Okay. I was even prepared to be wrong on that one. That's I said it subliminally to you in our own language.
All right, you get the Bible covered.
16 and 17, chapter 25, Proverbs. Reset. All right. So pretty simple, right? If you found honey, found something good, eat what you need, don't eat too much or you vomit, right? Anybody sat down like me to eat an Oreo and then a sleeve later, you're like, oh, bad, bad, bad idea, right? Like I can mow through Oreos. I have a spiritual gift. And then it gets really ugly after that, so, and my wife gets mad. So, eat what you need, right? A little of a good thing is a good thing. Too much of a good thing, not a good thing. One Oreo good, 27 Oreos bad, okay? It's not, the math does not work, okay? There's the illustration. 17, here's the application.
Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you.
All right, okay. So why is 17 the application of 16? Let your foot rarely be in your neighbor's house, or he will become weary and hate you.
Don't overstay your welcome.
Don't overstay your welcome, right? Now, how do you know how long your welcome is? Yeah, which means what? You've got to be, as an individual, what?
Attentive
to things other than
you,
right? This is a great quality that I see so many people are absolutely oblivious of, right? Me included on a lot of days, right? My day's about me. I'm focused on me, my needs. Man, I've had a rough day. I've had a good day. Oh, that girl was crying today. Oh, you know, I can't tell you how many times I get my hair cut. And my wife says, hey, how's Meadow doing? I'm like, ooh, like she's an old friend of ours. She's been cutting her hair forever. Goes to the well. I didn't ask her about how she was doing. Like, what did you talk about for 30 minutes? Me. Oh, is that not good? No, sweetheart. Yeah, she's had this going on in her family and this and the other thing you should ask her. I'm like, oh, okay. Maybe I'll remember next time. I've told you guys before this one that Ben Franklin said that fish and guests stink after 3 days, right? It works in our society in terms of like how long you stay, you're welcome. But it works for other things as well in terms of just being aware of other people's needs and feelings around you. Some of you are experts in this because of the way that God's wired you. Some of you are like, boy, you're starting from about 6.5 feet under like I do most days because of my lack of harmonizer, and it just doesn't come naturally, and I have to teach myself to not be an idiot, okay? So for those of you that are throwing left-handed like me, this is a good one for us to remember, okay? Just to be aware of, man, how are people interacting with me? What's going on in their world? How do I get outside of myself, okay? Because I am a persister, I have a lot of proverbs, so I've chosen to make it one and just put them all in one big category, and it's called insensitivity to other people. So, like, hey, when Mike's late for residency, please don't drive 30 miles an hour on Shepherd in the single lane road so I can't get around you. Like, just be aware, right, that there's other people on this road that want to just drive the speed limit. Okay, I don't need to go 90, but I would like to go 50, okay, because it's, right, so toilet paper goes over, not under. Okay, be aware of that, people. Okay, you're not going to be able to get married if you can't learn that lesson. So it goes over. That is proper. Okay, dishes go like this in the dishwasher. It'll go like that in the cupboard. I'm teasing. But, all right, good to be aware of these things. All right, so be aware of how your presence and your interactions affect those around you. Okay, and this is a, you talk about IQ, this is EQ, right? Is it emotional capacity? Quotient. Thank you. It's Q, not C. There you go. So, but that was the new buzzword, I don't know, 5 years ago when they were talking about hiring people. It's like, are they just like aware of you know, are they smart enough to be able to interact with other human beings like on a normal basis, okay? So it's amazing. That's what Proverbs are about, right? Can you interact with other people and not make them mad and want to cuss at you? So, okay? Thoughts on that? And if you think the paper goes the other way on the roll, unless we need to straighten that out. Because there are plenty of other churches in town you can go to if you believe that. All right. That would be good, wouldn't it? What did you like about residency? What did you learn? Mike taught us about toilet paper. It was good. All right. Yeah. We should stop there. Lots of thoughts. Filter's working. Good, good, good. Coffee has kicked in. All right, so 1 Samuel. Let's go back there. Let's talk about David this morning, little Saul. We'll finish up him, he, whom, whatever. And then we will move on to David. All right, let me pray for us, and then we will dive into the life of Saul and his kingship. Father, thanks for today. Thank you for a chance to dive into your word. Pray, Father, that you continue to reveal to us truth. And as we see Saul and his leadership today, God, pray that we would be able to glean wisdom from a guy who spent 40 years on the throne of Israel to watch the things that he did right and then watch the things that he did wrong. I pray that, God, we would be aware of the chinks in our armor, the cracks that lurk underneath our surface as we see those exposed now in Saul this morning, that we would be able to grapple and get a handle on those things, that they would not affect us for the duration of our lives. So, God, teach us this morning, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So, by the way, okay, just something to think about as you guys are thinking through really big picture stuff, a 30,000-foot views of Scripture. The United Kingdom, that starts with Saul, okay? Saul, David, Solomon, 40. They all reigned 40 years, so very easy, okay? So we're going to watch each of those guys reign in succession, okay? Saul's reign has started. He got anointed yesterday. And he will reign in Israel for 40 years under the United Monarchy. Okay, it's called United because at this point, Israel and Judah are still underneath one kingdom. Okay, we're going to see Judah mentioned this morning in a battle as like aside from the rest of Israel. And it's beginning, you're beginning to see this geographical base split in the kingdom. Okay, that will come to fruition after Saul dies and even more so. David's got to unite them kind of again, formally, and then under Solomon, it explodes and is permanently separated until post-exile, okay? So 40, each one of those guys reigns 40 years, all right? So we watched Saul get anointed king yesterday, hiding in the baggage, unfortunately. So you see some, the guy that's supposed to be the big, strong, tough guy, he's got some fear on the inside, okay? This morning, he's going to step up in a big way, okay? So Saul is going to have some initial success that is quite impressive, okay? So as you look at our handy-dandy chart, coronated in 10, 11, you're going to see him go out to battle, okay? And he's going to do some great stuff. 12, we're going to see a caution from Samuel as to how to rule, and he's going to use himself as an example of what godliness is supposed to look like in terms of leading a nation. And then 13 through 15, we're going to see Saul just nosedive, okay? He's going to drive the ship straight into the ground or the plane. That's the idea, okay? So let's pick up in, where do we leave off? Chapter 11, I believe. Okay, so he had last part of chapter 10, the hecklers that he chose not to do anything with. So again, as you're marking down qualities, that's a great one that I like in Saul. You're going to see another one in 11, many, if you will, because of who he is and how he starts, all right? So 11 verse 1, we've got a new issue. Not all at once. All right, you guys remember that town, Jabesh-Gilead? It's on the other side of the Jordan, right over there, okay? So they're up here. They're unprotected because they're on the other side of the Jordan. Saul and his camp is like all up in here, okay? So up in here, not over here. Okay, so they're isolated. These men, okay, the Ammonites, hello, Ammon, okay, they come up and basically say, we're going to spank you. And they said, okay, what do we do about that? So the men of Jabesh-Gilead, verse 2, say, well, let's do this, okay? Here's what they ask. Or they ask at the end, make a covenant with us and we'll serve you, so don't mess with us. And this is the response from the Ammonites.
But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, on this condition I will make a treaty with you, that I gouge out all your right eyes, and thus bring disgrace on all Israel.
That does not sound like good terms. You want a treaty? Okay, come here. I'm going to stab out your right eye, and then you can come serve us. Like, oh, we were hoping for better terms, but you're in the losing end of this deal, okay? So, that is their response. So, in verse 3, the elders of Jabesh say, hey, give us a week. Let us send some letters. Let us send, you know, an email out to the guys on the other side of the Jordan and see if they'll come rescue us. And if they won't come rescue us, then stab out all of our eyes and we'll come serve you. That's basically the answer, okay? Now, note to self, when Israel's choosing a king a couple chapters ago, and when they pushed on Samuel to say, give us a king, we're finding out that Ammon is becoming very strong. And Nahash had basically become a presence on the east. They've got the Philistines they're dealing with on the west. Saul's territory, as he takes the reign, is going like this quickly, okay? He is losing ground to everybody, okay? It's a sign of a spiritual dullness, his lack of military expertise, all these things. He's not a good king, okay? So one of the reasons that the people, and we see it from Samuel in a couple chapters, say, listen, we need a king, and we need a king now who can go fight battles, is because they literally did. Philistines are whooping them on the west. Nahash is coming from the east. They're in kind of a panic, and they need a king that can fight because God's not getting the job done in their eyes, okay? So that's their request. Give us 7 days. We'll send to the people, and if they, you know, if they respond, then we'll go to war. If not, then gouge your eyes out. Which is odd that, like, they would ask that. Secondly, it's odd that the Ammonites would go, okay, we'll give you a week. Like, why not just kill them all now, right? But they gave them a get-out-of-jail-free card for a week, okay? Verse 4, they send messages back to Gibeah, which is where Saul is. Okay, there again, here's Gibeah down here. But just in this area of Judah and the Benjamites, okay? So, Saul finds out, verse 5, read that.
Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and Saul said, what is wrong with the people that they are weeping? So they told him the news of the men of Jabesh.
By the way, what do you see Saul doing currently?
Working.
Right? What just happened the chapter before? You got an anointed king, and he is plowing the fields, right? So you see a great quality in him. He got anointed, but God has not called him to, I guess, the throne as of yet formally. So he goes back home and goes to work for his dad. That's what I do every day, right? So he's not too big for his britches at this point in his life. He goes home and he's like, great, fields need to be plowed. That's my job. So he does it, right? So you see some, again, great qualities in him initially, okay? He gets word. Hey, why are all the people crying? What's going on? And they report to Saul, hey, men of Jabesh-Gilead just got attacked. They're about to get spanked. If someone doesn't come rescue them, it's going to go very, very bad. Okay? Verse 6, this is his response.
The Spirit of God rushed upon Saul when he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen.
So you guys remember the FedEx package that got delivered at the end of the book of Judges, the harlot? Saul basically does the same thing with an oxen and says, y'all come to battle or this is what's going to happen to you. So we need to step up and fight. So strong message, right? Effective, right? Whether or not it was the best way to communicate it, that's up to you. But he gets the job done and he says, listen, we need to go fight, so let's go fight. And the people respond. And it looks like in verse 6, the Spirit of God is upon Saul. Verse 8, you'll notice that 300,000 men show up, and 30,000 of those men are from Judah. So they're going to fight. And you see this odd distinction between why is Israel and Judah being separated. Okay, you're seeing the geographic shift already. Okay, so verse 9, this is Saul's plan. Read that. Okay, so basically they've got to make this trek all night long down this wadi over to Jabesh-Gilead. So they're going to travel all night long until the sun comes up the next morning, and then they're going to fight. So they basically said, hey, by the time the sun is at high noon tomorrow, you're going to have deliverance. Okay, so that's their promise to them. Verse 11, it happened the next morning. Saul put the people in three companies. They came into the midst of the camp and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. It came about that those who had survived were scattered, and not two of them were left together. So Israel comes in, they take care of business, they rescue the men of Jabesh-Gilead, just like they had promised. Okay, so Saul comes together, rallies the troops, first victory in battle as a king. Yay, Saul. Okay, gets the job done. 12, keep going.
Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death."
So basically they were saying, hey, there's people around popping off saying, from Jabesh-Gilead specifically, or the other folks that were popping off at his coronation last chapter, who are the people that said they didn't like Saul reigning over us? Go ahead and bring them here and we'll put them to death now. Now that you've seen the victory of our king, notice Saul's response, 13.
But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel."
Hmm. Tell me about Saul. That's impressive, right? These are the guys that punked him publicly at his coronation. And he's got every ability, at the very least, to say, yeah, kill them all. You don't want me to be your king? We can solve that problem real fast, right? And he says, you know what? No. Today's about God. It's about his victory. You like the qualities that you see in this guy, right? Those are admirable. He's not out for vengeance. He's not about, at least right now, for the name on the back of his jersey type deal. It's not all about Saul. He's like, no, we're going to give glory to God. He won the battle. The men stepped up. We have no reason to be killing our own. Okay, so like that about him. Okay, Samuel says to him in verse 14, come, let us go down to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So we're going to re-coronate or celebrate this occasion. People went down to Gilgal, verse 15, made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. They also offered sacrifices and peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel greatly rejoiced. So this is Saul's heyday. Okay, it just happened. It's going to be short-lived, but there it is, right? So starts well, great victory in battle. That's the king they wanted, remember? Hey, come save us from, you know, Jabesh-Gilead, and these are the Ammonites, rather, that are attacking Jabesh-Gilead. This is the king that they wanted, okay? So out of the gates, it looks like, Samuel, what are you talking about? We don't want a king? Yeah, we do. Look at him fight. This is perfect. So they think everything's hunky-dory, and they've gotten the king that they wanted, and all's good, okay? Not so much, all right? Chapter 12, we're going to see a bit of a shift, okay? The focus is going to come off of Saul and now on back onto Samuel. He is reaching the end of his life and is about to die, okay? And he's going to offer kind of a, again, the typical short run through history, as well as a reminder to the people as to what they've done, okay? So 12 verse 1, let's pick up there. All right. One of the things Samuel's doing is basically throwing his integrity out before all the people and saying, you've seen me reign for all these years, okay? Here I am, bear witness against me in verse 3. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from those who I have taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it, I will restore it to you. That's a pretty big statement when you're in public in front of everybody and say, is there anybody here that I've done wrong in any way? I've got my checkbook out. Do I need to write any checks to anybody to make something right? Do I need to return a donkey? Nobody? That's how secure this guy is in integrity. So impressive leader, okay? And he says, they had verse 4 say, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hands. And that is the basis through which he's now going to lead from, okay? The Lord, verse 5, is witness against you and is anointed as witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand, okay? So he's claiming again his authority there, okay? 6 and following, he, again, walks through Old Testament history, what God's done, what Israel's done from Moses and Egypt and Jacob. You see all these names mentioned and how God took care of them. And then verse 12 ends at the verse that we were talking about earlier with Nahash. Read that. 12:12. Okay, so that again was one of their chief motivations for them wanting a king, was the power of the Ammonites, okay? And they're also getting squeezed on the other side again by the Philistines, okay? So now he's going to offer a pretty stern rebuke. Keep going to 13. Okay, remember the king that you have chosen, the king that you have asked for. What does Saul's name mean? Asked for. So you wanted it. There you go. Okay. Now, this is fascinating. 14. Even though this wasn't what God wanted, what does he say?
If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well.
Okay. So, What's Samuel saying about this current situation? Even though God didn't want you to have a king. It's good, right? Can we live in this condition? Absolutely. Okay. God says, I'll bless this situation. You follow me, let the king follow me. Now remember, Saul's there watching all this happen as well, right? So this is his coronation, basically, that just finished in end of chapter 11. Okay, so you walk with God, the king walks with God, God will bless that, okay? He's not happy about it, but he will allow that to take place, okay? It's one of those weird, tense deals, okay? Because Samuel, in just a couple verses, is going to say, y'all sinned for asking for a king, okay? So it's like, can God bless our stupid decisions at times, or at least honor them? Yes, okay? Thank goodness, right? If you will not listen, verse 15, to the voice of the Lord and rebel against the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. Okay, even now, take your hand and see that this thing which you that the Lord will do before your eyes. So in order to prove kind of God's presence, this is what he says in verse 17. Watch what he calls down. Read that.
Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord, asking for yourselves a king.
All right, so how does Samuel see them asking for a king? It's wicked, right? It's not. He ain't mixing words here, right? They should not have done this, okay? And then he says, I'm gonna call down thunder and rain during the wheat harvest, okay? Wheat harvest is May to June. This would be akin to saying, there's going to be a gigantic thunderstorm rolling through Fresno in June. A, we never see thunderstorms. B, it certainly isn't coming in June, right? That's what he's saying, like right now, right? For those of you that have never seen a thunderstorm and never been to Texas or the Midwest or Oklahoma or Kansas, y'all have not seen thunderstorms, okay? They are freaky. Shake your windows, shake your house, make you cry like a baby, okay? So we get rain here and things that sound like thunder, but aren't quite. So it's funny the things you miss. You're like, I haven't heard a thunderstorm in like 10 years, right? Go back to visit Texas and boom! Like, oh, that's awesome. So yeah, don't want to live in it all the time, but they're fun if you haven't heard them, okay? For a little bit, right? So he's going to call down rain. So verse 18, read that. That's right, like, God, thunderstorm, now. Boom! Like, okay, he's not messing around. So last year when we were in Israel, we were in, again, same time of year we're going, it's June. We're rolling through one of the wadis heading down to the Dead Sea, okay? And out of nowhere comes this huge black cloud, and it starts dumping rain. I mean, weird. And Ronan, our guide's like, I haven't seen this in 20 years in Israel. It's the most bizarre thing. And literally, within 4 minutes of rain, there's a flash flood coming through all these wadis. It's insane, okay? So rain in that type of year is bizarre. It doesn't ever happen. And the land is not quite set up to deal with it. So they have these gigantic floods because of the wadis, okay? So which you guys have learned about in your videos and such, okay? So we'll see those when we get over there, all right? So rain comes, and then people freak out. 19, keep going.
Then all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God so that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king. Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart.
Yeah, what a great response, right? He doesn't say sin's not sin. He's like, yeah, you've done this, but serve God, okay? Be true to your word, serve God, let the king serve God, and we're going to be good, okay? You must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things, which you cannot profit which cannot profit because they are futile. Okay, 22, the Lord will abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord, for the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name. He's been pleased to make you a people for himself. 23, this is a great reminder as a leader. What a convicting verse. Read that. This is what Samuel says to the people.
Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. And I will instruct you in the good and the right way.
Isn't that great? Like, Samuel says, man, it would be a sin for me as a leader not to continue to pray for you guys. So I'm going to continue to pray for my people because God has asked me to steward you guys. Okay, so beautiful verse. All right, and just in terms of his leadership. So 12 is all about, Saul, you started great. Buddy, make sure that you don't get too big for your britches. Walk with God. People walk with God. Yes, this was a dumb idea. However, God will use it if you guys will just walk with him. Okay, so 13:1. Let's pick up there and let's watch now. Things turn south for Saul.
Saul lived for 1 year and then became king. And when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel.
All right, so stop right there, real quick. There's a lot of contextual, there's number problems in this verse. So the numbers of this verse have apparently been lost, okay? And it was. It can read a couple different ways. So this can either be a summary statement of his entire reign. My Bible says Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 42 years over Israel. Okay, so 40, 42, okay, that's the idea. Yours translates it differently. So the numbers are gone, and they're trying to figure out, are we summarizing his entire reign, or are we fast-forwarding a year or two into his reign? Okay, regardless, what happens in this chapter is still important, right? So there you go. Keep going, Mitch.
Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the whole country of Bethel. And 1,000 there with Jonathan in Gibeah on Benjamin.
All right, so who's Jonathan? First time we've met this guy.
His son.
This is Saul's son, okay? And he is going to be, Jonathan's bad, okay? Verse 3, read that.
Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it.
Okay, so Jonathan is a lieutenant, basically, of Saul's in his army. This guy can fight. That's how we're introduced to him. He's a stud, okay? And would have been, obviously, what would have been his place in the kingdom? If his dad's king and he's prince, he's next in line for the kingship, okay? So just important as you think about Jonathan to bear that in the back of your mind, okay? So they're now going to battle, okay? All Israel heard the news of what Saul had done. People were summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. Not good if you're Israel, right? There are a bunch of people and you're about to get spanked, okay? Verse 6, let's keep going. Let's see the condition that Israel is in. All right, so that's a bad day when you're hiding in caves. Okay, we're going to see. We're going to go explore those caves when we get over to Israel. These cave structures that they have are insane. I mean, we will, I think, this year visit an entire underground city. The entire city was built underground, okay, through caves and caverns. And so Israel is set up that way. And there's places that you can crawl literally for miles and miles underground in just these tubes. So if those of you that like spelunking, and such, Israel's got some amazing places that we'll see some, okay? But for those of you that are claustrophobic like me, it'll be a challenge, okay? So, or you can tap out and say, thank you, but no, okay? That's fine as well, all right? But fascinating. So these people are hiding in caves, okay? And we're going to see the significance of this area, specifically in the life of David, and his hiding from Saul later on in his reign, okay? So here's the problem, verse 8, okay? We've got a battle ready to happen. People are freaking out. Philistine army is gigantic. They just came off of defeating Nahash, the Ammonite. Now they've got to go do battle with the Philistines. They're outnumbered, and they're waiting for Samuel to get there to bring an offering so that they can go to battle. So read 8 and 9.
Samuel
All right, so here you have, paint the situation. People are freaking out, they're hiding in caves, they're going away, they saw the Philistines coming. Samuel said, apparently to Saul, I'll be there in a week. Okay, wait, before we go to battle, I will offer a sacrifice as a, not apparently is his role is this, he's the operating priest at this time, though he's not from the tribe of Levi. He gets to, that's his job, okay? So he's, I guess, grafted in. Saul is in a panic because what's happening to his army is they're watching the Philistines assemble. They're leaving. So he's like, oh, doo-doo, what do I do? Like, everyone's panicked, everyone's leaving. Samuel's late, okay? I waited the 7 days, and you're not here, okay? So this is his answer, verse 9. Ooh, what do you think is going to happen now? So what is Saul's position? He is king. Is he priest? No. Can he offer sacrifices and burnt offerings? No, it's not his job, okay? Sounds spiritual. He's trying to interact with God. He's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to get God's blessing on this battle. Samuel's late, okay? And I want you to watch Saul's rationale for doing this, okay? And I look at it and I go, yeah, I think I probably would have made the exact same decision Saul did, okay? Soon as he finished, of course, as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering in 10, look who shows up. Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him, okay? But Samuel knows what's happened. He reads and he says this to him. Verse 11.
Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattering from me,
you see his three things that he says, okay? Samuel says, what have you done? He said, man, I saw that the people were scattering. People are freaking out. I'm a leader. I need to rally the people. Secondly, you're late. You gave your word. You said you'd be here in a week. You didn't come. And thirdly, the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. They're ready to fight. They're coming. We can't stop them. So what was I to do? That's his answer, okay? And I look at that and I go, seems logical to me. Makes perfect sense as to why you would force the offering. So the wrong guy's not right, but God will bless it because my heart's right, even though I'm not going through the right things that I know or whatever. God will take care of it, right? Not so much. Verse 12, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal. I have not asked the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. So yeah, that's what I did, okay? Now, 13 is a stern rebuke from Samuel to Saul.
Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you.
Like, wow, that is a stern rebuke with huge consequences. It's almost like Moses, right? One popping off in anger, you're done. You're not going to the promised land. You're on the bench. Take you up the mountain. You're going to die. Joshua gets to go in. You get a great job for 40 years. You blew it one time and you're done. This is a big deal to God. So Samuel told him, Saul knew better than to offer the sacrifice, and he did it, and he said, hey, you would have had a throne that would have endured not just with you, but for how long? Forever, had you just obeyed. Like, that is, oh. God says, I am transferring the kingdom from you to somebody else, and what is the quality of the man that God has in reserve? Someone after his own heart, okay? You're going to see that repeated numerous times of the next king that's coming. Okay, someone after his own heart. Obviously, that's David. Okay, so we know who's coming. Okay, so what do you think Saul thinks about that? Probably not real happy, right? Yeah, not so much, right? So Samuel arose, went up from Gilgal to Gibeah and Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people. So Samuel goes home. You blew it, and he leaves. Okay, like, ouch. Saul numbered the people who were with them, about 600 men. How many did they start with? I don't know that we saw a number. We saw Israel's. Anyway, 600 men left after a chapter ago when they had 300,000 fighting dudes. That's not good. So everyone's turned tail and run home. Okay, now, Jonathan's there with them, and they're going to go fight. Okay, pick up in, let's see. We get a kind of a detail here. So they go to battle. They camp at Michmash. 17, the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah, to the land of Shual. Okay, so they're coming after them. 19, interesting, just side note on what's going on. No blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel. So there's no one to make swords. So look who has to make swords for them. They have to go down to the Philistines to sharpen their plowshares or their whatever, all their farming tools. They have to get turned into weapons of warfare by the enemy's blacksmiths. So you think they charge them a pretty penny? They do. Okay, so 21 and following talks about this exorbitant cost that they're paying. As a result, the only people that had swords were like Saul and Jonathan. Okay, so the battles are coming. Okay, so 14, let's watch how this battle goes down. Pick up 14:1.
One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father.
So they're lined up for battle. They're way outnumbered. And Jonathan says, let's go invade their camp. Just me and you. Two guys. Okay? So Jonathan's bad. Okay? He's like, "I'm not scared." Okay? Let's go. Doesn't tell his dad. They just leave. Okay? Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah. Okay? He's got about 600 men with him, okay? And we find out in verse 3, at the end of verse 3, nobody knows that he's gone. Okay, so Jonathan and his armor bearer go, okay? Verse 4, pick up there.
Within the passage by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez. The name of the other, Sinai. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Gibeah.
Okay, so he's crawling through rocks trying to get to the Philistine army, right? So he's protected and hiding, okay? Verse 6, Jonathan said to his young man who's carrying his armor, "Come, let us cross over the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." Like, that is a bad statement, right? Bad isn't good, okay? Two guys, they're going up against 30,000 guys, and he says, "God can do whatever he wants. He can win the battle with 600,000 people from Israel or us two. Let's go. Let's see what happens." So this guy is bold. He's not scared. And his armor bearer says, "Great, do all that's in your heart," okay? And then this is the plan, okay? Verse 8, this is an odd request, okay? Or a pretty scary thing to do, given that they're trying to be sneaky.
"And Jonathan said, 'Behold, we will cross over to the men and we will show ourselves to them.'"
We'll just stand up and say, "Hey, here we are, just the two of us. Hi," right? Like, dude, are you an idiot? And apparently not. Keep going. So if they say, "Hey, y'all stay right there, we're going to come down to you," bad day. If they say, "Hey, come on up to us," then they know God's given the entire army into their hand. Like, bold, right? This guy's nuts, okay? Verse 12, "So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, 'Come up to us and we will tell you something.'" So how did it go for Jonathan when he got the news? Good, that's exactly what they wanted. So Jonathan came up. He climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor bearer behind him, and his armor bearer put some to death after him. Sorry, I missed the part where Jonathan put people to death. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer put some to death. Okay, verse 14, "The first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half a furrow in an acre of land." So they get after it. Okay, so they're fighting in a small area and just killing fools, right? 15, "There was a trembling in the camp in the field and among the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling." Who just showed up to help them do battle? God, right? So this is crazy, right? So Jonathan is a guy that is, man, he's daring, he's bold, he's calculated apparently, even though he's nuts, and God blesses what he's doing, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So God shows up and fights this battle for them, and they take down some Philistines, okay? 16, back to Saul in this story. Pick up there. Okay, so they realize that there are people missing that have left the camp. Okay, 18, keep going.
So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the Ark of God here." So the Ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel.
Okay, so Ahijah is the high priest at the time, so he's the new king on the block. Okay, so Saul calls Ahijah and says, "Bring the Ark of God here. It's going with them into battle." And he's wanting the high priest's blessing on this battle that they're about to go into. 19, watch what happens.
Now while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand."
So what is he asking the high priest to do? Bring the priest, bring the ark. What is he wanting? Yeah, some type of assurance of victory. He's wanting to pray. Wanting to do something spiritual, right? I screwed that up last chapter, so you do it, okay? Do something spiritual, okay? Now, while they're doing this, the Philistines are coming at them for battle, okay? So Saul says to Ahijah, "Withdraw your hand." What does that mean? Come over here and pray. Oh, wait, here come all the Philistines. Ahijah, withdraw your hand. We don't need you right now. Not need you, or what's he saying? We don't have time for this. We don't have time for spiritual stuff. The Philistines are right there. Go away, right? We need to fight. So he does. Saul said to all the people who were with him, "Every man to battle. Behold, every man's sword was against him," and there was a great confusion. Like, the Philistines just came upon him, and he said, "Leave us alone." Now, there was another leader named Samuel who just went through a few chapters ago this exact same situation. You guys remember that? He calls the people. The Philistines were coming. He's getting ready to offer sacrifice, and he sees all the Philistines coming after him. What does Samuel do? He prays and finishes offering the sacrifice, and what did God do that day? The Philistines killed each other, right? Saul says, "Oh no, we don't have time for spiritual things. Ahijah, go away. Take the ark away. We got to go fight." Okay, so difficult situation, right? He's in a jam, and his knee-jerk reaction, because Saul is a guy that does not have a heart for God, is to do what? Turn to the physical or turn to the spiritual? Physical, okay? Another thing to think through is you think through the three kings of Israel. Saul, no heart. David, all heart. Solomon, divided heart. Saul, you're going to see, starts good, but boy, he is a nightmare spiritually towards God. That's what gets exposed. So he looks good initially until we start getting down to the onion layers on the bottom. Okay, and we find out that his heart is dark towards the things of God. Okay, really dark. The end of 1 Samuel will surprise you to the depths of which he's willing to go to walk away from God. Okay, so does some creepy things. All right. So he says, "Go away. We need to fight." However, look at verse 23. Who shows up? God shows up, delivers Israel that day, even in the midst of this boneheaded decision by Saul, okay? And now Saul's going to make an even harsher vow. Read that.
"Now the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, but Saul had put the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats the food before evening, and until I have arranged myself on my enemies.' So none of the people take the food."
So think about this. You guys just got snuck attacked by the Philistines. You fight this huge battle, and then what does Saul say? After the battle, what do you think the guys want to do? Eat. They're hungry, right? And he says, nobody eats until what? Verse 24. "Till I've had vengeance." Not God, me. I need to go prove a point. Nobody gets to eat. Now, Guys aren't the most spiritual group ever, right? They tend to be a lot more spiritual when they've eaten. This is a bad leadership move, right? He's going to make these guys now march all night long and fight yet another battle, and he's going to cause his people to sin because of this decision, okay? So he says nobody gets to eat anything, okay? At this point, Saul does not know that Jonathan's missing, okay? He doesn't know that he's gone. So he makes this kind of rash vow. That's the idea. And Jonathan has not heard this vow that his dad made because he's separated. Verse 27 tells us that. Jonathan had not heard about what his father had done to the people and put them underneath this oath because he wasn't there. He was off fighting Philistines somewhere else. Okay? So, yeah. 26, when the people entered the forest, as they're now traveling to finish this battle, there's this big pot of honey, right? Big flow of honey. But no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. So nobody even wanted a taste test because they were afraid that they would die. Okay, but Jonathan didn't know, so he eats of the honey, as does, I think it's just him, not his armor bearer, but he eats of it. And then 28, the people tell him after he's eaten it, your father strictly told us, hey, don't do this. And Jonathan's response is, in 29 is a stern kind of rebuke to his dad. Read 29.
Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great.
So what is Jonathan saying about his dad's decision? It is bad. You're not thinking about the people. You're thinking about you. How selfish is that, right? He says, my dad's troubled Israel. Okay, and I'm going to get punished because I've tasted a little honey. How much better would it have been if had all you eaten? How do you think the battle would have gone had all of us had a chance just to eat, refresh ourselves? And Saul, again, his concern at this point now is turning inward. It's about my reputation, and you people are tools to accomplish my will. Okay, not a good leader. What type of leader do you see Jonathan is, by the way? Great in battle, okay? What's he thinking about here? The people, right? He would have made a great king, right? Phenomenal guy. You're going to see that he loves God. He's got the concern for the people. The people, in turn, by the way, love Jonathan. You're going to see that at the end of this chapter, okay? They love him. They respond to him. He's very different than his dad, okay? So he makes this statement like, man, that was dumb, okay? Verse 31, they struck the Philistines that day at Michmash, and the people were very weary. So they finish now the second battle with no food, and watch what happens in 32.
People pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood.
Like, how hungry are you when you run into a city and you just start killing animals and eating them? Like, no fire, no cooking. Like, these guys are weary and hungry. So they've lost all self-control. Whose fault is that? It's Saul's. It's his responsibility, right? So he told the people, but he's been, unfortunately, he caused this, okay? Verse 33, behold, the people are sinning against you by eating the blood. He finds out, and he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me this day. So this is a reproach, is the idea. Disperse yourselves, verse 34, among the people, and say, everyone bring me your sheep, slaughter it here. We're not going to eat it with the blood in it. So he's trying to make it right, but the people have blown it. Okay, as a result, 35, Saul does something he hasn't done in his reign yet. Read that. First thing that he's ever built on his own initiative to God, saying, right? So he's still got a glimmer of hope in him, but boy, he has blown it and is trying to get right, trying to make an altar, trying to do something that's good. Okay, as a result of this, Saul's got to go into another battle with the Philistines. 37, he asked, hey, God, do you want me to go? Notice end of verse 37, what does God say to him? Ouch. Right? Nothing from God. God, should I go? Silence. Okay? Saul said, draw near. Verse 38, all you chiefs and you people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. So Saul's intuitive enough to realize, God's not answering me. Something's happened. Why does he think something's happened? Why would God not be answering Saul right now? He made a vow, right? No one's to eat. What happened? Somebody ate of the honey, and Saul doesn't know who it is yet, but he needs to find out, and he realizes that's why God shut it down, okay? He makes now a second rash vow. The first one was no one gets to eat. 39, he realizes somebody has eaten, and here's his promise.
As the Lord lives, who saved Israel, though it be in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die.
So he's saying, even if it's Jonathan who ate, I'll kill him right now. Like, oh, buddy. Lo and behold, it is Jonathan, okay? So they cast lots. They get down all the way to Saul and Jonathan. Saul and Jonathan cast lots. The lot falls on Jonathan. In 43, Saul says, tell me what you have done. Jonathan's answer, end of verse 43. Read this.
So Jonathan told him and said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die.
What do you notice in his response? What do you like about the way he responds? Yep. Accepts the consequences. Does he make excuses? No. Do we know how Jonathan felt about his dad's decision? Yeah, he thought it was stupid. But he says, yep, I dipped my honey and I ate from the end of my staff. I did it. I'm ready to accept. Here I am, I must die. Like, buddy, like that's impressive. Okay, so again, phenomenal leader. Okay. Saul said, may God do this to me, and even more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. What do you think he was hoping to get from his dad? Oh, it's okay. Just go back. You know, we're good, right? No, Saul says, great. You're dead. I promised to kill you. Like, you kind of get the idea that Saul's a little screwy in the head at this point. Like, maybe he needs some honey to eat as well to, like, get his blood sugar back up so he can think straight. He's not making real good decisions right now. Why? What is his motivation right now? What did he say earlier? Why is he pushing his people so hard? Yeah, I'm trying to put my name on the front of the paper. I got to go win battles, and I've got to be seen as important in Israel. Okay? And that's his focus. It's about him. Okay? Which is, by the way, why David is going to be such a threat to Saul. Because all of a sudden, this new kid's going to come on the block, and the attention's going to turn from Saul onto this young punk kid. And that just blows Saul's mind, and insecurity overwhelms him. Okay, so he says, we're going to kill you. 45, look who steps in to save Jonathan.
But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die.
How about that? You see the contrast in the leadership between how the people see Jonathan and the people see Saul? The people have to step in and say, we love that guy. God has worked through him today. Really? You're going to kill him, your son, for doing what? For doing basically God's bidding, and the people rescue him from his father's hand. So you can see that Saul probably needed to be medicated. I don't know what was going on with him, but boy, he is jacked in the head in a lot of ways. Okay, so trying hard, but boy, man, he just got the focus off of God and onto himself in a hurry. Okay, so all ends well, okay, and Jonathan is saved that day, okay? Verse 47, when Saul had taken over the kingdom of Israel, he fought against all the enemies on every side, Moab, Amnon, Edom. You see all these kings listed. Part of Saul's reign is just that, man, he is dealing with all these different people, right? 48, he does well. He attacks valiantly, defeats the Amalekites, delivers Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. So he goes to battle. He steps up. But this is the story that we get of Saul. Constant battle, constant fighting for land. Spiritual temperature in the land right now is kind of at a minimal. He's just not doing a great job. 49 and following, we get a bit of his family history, who his kids and daughters are. Notice at the end of verse 49, he's got two daughters, Merab, and the younger was Michael. Okay, so these are his two, Saul's two daughters, and he's got a couple other sons other than Jonathan that aren't necessarily important for the sake of our story. Okay. Last verse, 52, Saul would continually add valiant men to his staff as he saw them in their ability to fight. Okay, so 15 is kind of an odd chapter in what God's about to ask Saul to do. Okay, this is God's request, verse 2, 15:2, read that.
But says the Lord of hosts, I have noted that Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, cattle and donkey.
So boy, this is the Amalekites, kill them all. Men, women, child, infant, sheep, donkeys, king, everybody go kill them, okay? Anybody got a cross reference in verse 2 from the book of Deuteronomy? You see that? Chapter 25, there's a reference in my Bible to verse 2, okay? What did Amalek specifically do? It mentions it here, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming out of Egypt, he being Israel. What did the Amalekites do to Israel on their way out of Egypt? Yeah, they attacked the rear, and at the rear was who? Women and children. And God said, I take offense to that. So God basically has a wrath that has been stored up for the Amalekites, and he's pushed the pause button all these years. And now he's saying, Saul, you are going to go now be my instrument of wrath. It's time, okay? You guys remember when way back in Genesis 15, God is telling Abram about the sand on the seashore and how many offspring he's going to have, and we're going to take you out of Israel. And he says, the iniquity of the Amalekite is not yet complete, meaning I am going to allow these people to live even in the midst of their grotesque sin and what they have done to Israel. But one day my wrath will come. It's due. Okay, so their wrath has been on credit, and God says, you're paying the bill now. Okay, so they've had a chance to live in the midst of this, and though it is a harsh judgment, it is also a right judgment. Okay, they did Israel dirty, and God says, we're not going to have that. So for whatever reason, God says to Saul, you're going to go take care of this. Okay, Saul wasn't even around when the Exodus happened. He's heard maybe of the story, but that's the extent of it. And God says, go take care of it. Okay, so he does. Okay, so he takes verse 4, 20,000 foot soldiers, 10,000 men from Judah, okay, they set an ambush. They go down, and God says, hey, by the way, don't mess with the Kenites, okay? So they are part of these traveling nomad groups, but when you kill everybody, leave the Kenites alone, okay? Who are the Kenites? What famous people do we know that were Kenites? Why would God say, spare these nomadic people from Midian? Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a Kenite. He says, don't mess with them. They're good guys, okay? So because of Jethro's obedience, Jethro's son that went with Moses, Moses' brother-in-law, helps him go see in the wilderness and during that journey. He says, don't mess with them, okay? So verse 7, Saul defeated the Amalekites. Verse 8, he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed with all the people, the edge of the sword, okay? So Saul takes the king and destroys everything else, okay? Almost everything else. Verse 9, read that.
But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and of the fattened calves and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction.
So what do they do? What did God tell them to do? Get rid of everything. And what do? They keep the good stuff and get rid of the stuff that's garbage, right? Exactly what God wants when we sacrifice to him. I'll keep the good stuff. All the leftover scrawny sheep that are like three-legged and lame, you can have those, God, right? That's what God wants. God says, no, this is complete obedience. I want everything killed, okay? So Samuel shows up, and watch this speech in verse 11. Boy, this is harsh. Okay, these are Samuel's words repeating what God said.
And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night.
He's praying for Saul because of his sin. That's amazing because Saul and Samuel's relationship is not so hot right now, right? Last time they met was it when Saul offered the sacrifice and Samuel's like, what have you done, you idiot? And then goes home, right? That was their last interaction that we saw. Okay. Samuel's distressed, prays all night because God has given him this information. Samuel rose early and he goes to meet Saul, and Saul meets him now at Carmel, okay, which we're going to go to in Israel. And behold, he set himself a monument for himself, right? Good job, Saul. Make yourself a trophy, okay, and put it where everybody can see it. So now they're going to have a conversation. 13, read that.
Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord."
Right? So, yay! Hey, good to see you, Samuel. I've done everything God asked, right? He just won a victory. He killed most everything. They kept the king and a couple good things, right? 14, this is a haunting response.
But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?"
Like, what? What? I'm sorry. Saul, you did everything? What is this bleating of sheep that I hear then? Why do I hear goats and sheep in the background? Like, you clearly didn't kill everything. Like, it's just a punk, right? Now, Saul is this godly leader who takes responsibility. Notice 15, how he owns his sin.
Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed."
So whose fault is it? The people did it. They kept the things, and why did they keep them? We're going to sacrifice them. It's a spiritual thing, Samuel. Okay? Surely Samuel's going to... See how he's working the angles? We've kept these things so that we can have a huge offering to God. But that's not what God told you to do. Okay? This is a phenomenal chapter on externals versus internals. Okay? And it's fascinating. Okay? This may have even been true. Like, there may have been a motive for him to say, "We're going to sacrifice all of the best. We're not keeping it for us. We're getting rid of all the weak stuff because God doesn't want that. And we're going to sacrifice the best of the best to God," right? We're keeping it, okay? The problem is, who else does he keep?
The king.
The king. Why would he have kept the king? What is the king to Samuel, or to Saul? A token. He's a trophy. He's a, "Look who I defeated. Why don't we parade him around? Put some handcuffs on. Put him in shackles, right? Look who I defeated," okay? That is a star on the side of his helmet. That's what Agag is to Saul, okay? And Samuel realizes that, okay? Now, verse 16, Samuel's response. Keep going.
"Then Samuel said to Saul, 'Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night.' And he said to him, 'Speak.' Samuel said, 'Is it not true, though, that you were little in your own eyes? You were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated.'"
So 17, he says, "Man, you were a nobody, and God exalted you. He made you something. You were little in your own eyes, and yet God put you in this amazing position. He gave you a command." Verse 19, "Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord and rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" So even if your motives were right, you did not do what God told you to do. So, great lesson in the life of Saul. Is there such thing as partial obedience? No. And we see that all over the book of Joshua as well, right? Hey, we killed almost everybody. Well, guess what? Almost everybody is not everybody, which is why Saul, hundreds of years later, is having to deal with the consequences of that, as will David and everybody else. And we, when we go to Israel, will see the consequences of that. Partial obedience, no worky. Okay? So, you did not obey the voice of God. Okay? Verse 20, Saul says now to Samuel, "I did obey the voice of God." Like, wow, now you're going to argue with Samuel. Okay. "And went on a mission, which the Lord gave me, have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." I did do it, okay? "But the people took some of the spoil, the sheep and the oxen, the choices of the things devoted for destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Samuel, you just don't understand. We did, but we're keeping all the stuff, and we're going to have a sacrifice. And now that you're here, you can offer it all. It's a party. God will be happy. That's not what God asked. 22, this is haunting. Read 22 and 23.
Samuel said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is the fat of rams."
What does that mean? Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to heed better than the fat of rams. Okay, that's a piece of it. Keep going. Yeah. What would be the external here? All these offerings. And are those biblical? Yeah. Does God delight in offerings? Does he have a whole book called Leviticus on offerings? Yeah. Does God like that stuff? Of course. What's better than offerings? Just obey. It's not impressive. It's not external. It's not a show. It's just obey God. Why is it better to obey than to offer sacrifices? Isn't sacrifices the external sign of obedience? Yeah. So why is obedience better?
It all stems from the obedience at this point, like David, a heart after God.
Can you still sacrifice and have a jacked heart? See also Saul, right? You look really impressive on the outside, Saul. However, you're not obeying. Can you obey? And I guess you can. But obedience is what the... It's the external sign of a heart that says, "Lord, that's what you want me to do. And I want to obey you, so I'm going to do it," right? So he's saying, man, you've got it all jacked, Saul. You're about you. You're not about God. You're trying to get your name in the paper as well, and you're trying to find an end around to do this, okay? It's a great commentary on your Old Testament. Is God just about sacrifices and systems and do this and do that and offer this and offer that? That's not the purpose of any of this, right? And that was the danger that the Jews got caught up in, even today. It's this external rigmarole, do this, set fences, obey laws, do all these things, and yet your heart can be completely jacked, right? But can you carry your Bible to church and sing the worship songs and quote scripture and look really spiritual and beat someone in Bible trivia? Good for you. Who cares, right? The hardest thing in my life isn't that. The hardest thing in my life is to obey and to have a heart that's not wicked and about me, right? So that's ultimately what God wants, and that's what Saul lost in the process, okay? And that's, lest you think the Old Testament is about God delighting himself and all these external things, that was never, ever the purpose of it. And the Jews, I think, unfortunately, have lost that focus, okay? Especially today, when they don't have a temple to sacrifice in, how do they obey God? How do they offer sacrifices? You know what the new temple is? Obedience to the law. So they've exalted the Mosaic law and said we have to obey that more than ever before because we don't have the system. We don't have a temple. We don't have an altar. We don't have a holy of holies. We have nothing to obey God on that level, so we must follow the law fully. Okay, so don't trim your beards, no polyester and cotton together. There's a reason why you see all these external signs of obedience. Phylacteries on their heads and on their, you know, God. And there's nothing wrong with those things, so long as they come from a heart of obedience. But if you're trying to earn God's favor based on all those external things, it doesn't work that way, okay? So God tells Saul, buddy, you're jacked, okay? So 24, rebellion is the sin. Rebellion is the sin of divination, and insubordination is the iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. So now, just a clear second time, punking from Samuel, you are not going to be the king any longer. Okay? 24, pick up there. All right, that sounds pretty good. Okay? So he confesses. That sounds awesome. Okay? Keep going. What does he say? Read between the lines here. Therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. Return with him where? To whom? This is a private conversation that's happening. To the rest of the people. Return with me to the rest of the people. Why? hey, Samuel still likes me. It's all good. Again, we're good. People are going to think more. You see what Saul's trying to protect? His reputation. Okay? So return with me. Watch Samuel's response. 26. Ouch. Like, no. Like, buddy, we're done. God's done with you. I'm not going to return with you and show approval when God has not approved you, okay? And then you get an audio visual here in 27. Samuel turned to go. Saul seized the edge of his robe and it tore. So Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you, i.e. obedient. Okay? Fascinating. So, strong sense of a rebuke there, okay? Also, the glory of Israel, i.e. God, will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. God has made a statement. You are in sin. He's promised the kingdom to another. He's not backing down on that promise, okay? He's not a man that he waffles in his decision-making, okay? Now, we see, obviously, at times God allow people opportunities to repent, and he will change his way, but the heart of God in this matter is not going to change, okay? In verse 30, you see the core motive behind Saul come out.
Then he said, I have sinned, yet honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return me, that I might bow before the Lord your God.
You hear him? Like, come honor me before the people. Okay, that's what matters to him, not God. Okay? Samuel now goes back with him. Okay? 32, read that. This is haunting.
Then Samuel said, bring here to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came in cheerfully. Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past.
Okay, so why is Samuel asking for Agag? He's going to finish what God asked Saul to do. Okay, how does Agag come into the presence of Samuel? He's like, bring it, dude. Like, surely the bitterness of death is past. Like, here's a white robe wearing old dude, should have been retired priest, and you got Saul who, man, if I was going to die, that's the guy that would have killed me, right? He's the guy that goes to battle. This is a priest. I'm good. Okay, now, anybody have a different translation? Does yours read any differently in 32 as to what Agag said? Okay, let me read you what it could mean, okay? The Hebrew is unclear. It may mean cheerfully. He came to Saul or Samuel cheerfully or in fetters, and surely the bitterness of death is past may also be translated, now comes bitter death. So he's either coming thinking, hey, it's good. I'm cheerful because I'm not going to die, or he's now coming in fetters realizing I'm about to lose my head. I think the right translation is the way our Bibles read, which is, he thinks he's all good, okay? There's a movie clip that I watched 15 years ago on this scene, and it still sticks in my brain, okay? Samuel said, as your sword, he's speaking now to Agag, has made women childless, so your mother will be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. As Saul stands there and watches. And he says, Saul, let me teach you something about obedience. This is what God wanted, and that's what God's going to get. We're going to finish the job. So, rough scene, okay? But that's what goes down, okay? 35, finish the chapter there. Or 34 and 35.
And Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. But Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel.
Okay, it's regretted is the same idea. If you guys remember the flood, God was sorry. He feels grief over an ungodly leader leading his people. Okay, so see also chapter 16. Okay, here comes the next king. All right, 16:1, let's pick up there.
The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel?
What's Samuel's condition, by the way, regarding Saul? How does he feel about this?
Looks like depression.
He's depressed. He's grieved. Why? That's a very godly response. Would you agree? How would a fleshly response respond to the situation? Samuel and Saul. Who's right in this situation? Samuel, who's wrong? Saul. Told you so, idiot, right? Like, that would have been a normative, like, why would he grieve over that? You're an ungodly chump. But he's grieved over the fact that God has put him in this position of leadership, and he's blown it. And it hurts him, right? So Samuel's a godly dude, and Saul says, hey, or God says, hey, stop grieving. It's time to get out of your mourning clothes. We're now going to go exalt the next king, okay? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. Okay? So, one of Jesse's sons is about to get crowned, essentially, the next king. Okay? Verse 2, keep going.
But Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me.
So, that's bad, right? When Samuel fears his own life to exalt the next king that God wants, right? Saul's in a dark spot, okay? Going downhill fast. Keep going.
Take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. You shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one whom I designate to you.
All right, so he says, go, tell him you're going to sacrifice. Okay, tell Jesse, tell Saul if anyone asks, and you're going to bring Jesse and all his kids to this sacrifice, and you're going to anoint one of the kids for Jesse to be the next king of Israel. Okay, so Samuel rolls in, verse 4, keep going.
Samuel did what the Lord said and came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, did you come in peace?
So, last time you showed up, you had a sword in your hand. Like, are we good? Right? So, he says, oh yeah, we're good. Keep going.
He said, in peace, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. He also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to sacrifice.
All right, so he tells Jesse what he's going to do, okay? Jesse, come, bring your sons. We're about to crown the next king. One of your sons, by the way, Jesse, okay? He entered, okay, and he does this. Now, if you're Jesse, it's pretty crazy, right? You're a Bethlehemite, not big man on campus, and God just says, one of your sons is about to be the next king. Bring them all to the party. We're going to have a sacrifice, and then Samuel's going to choose, okay? How many of your sons would you bring? All, right? That would be the normative response, right? Jesse's got 7 or 8 sons, I forget, and 2 daughters, okay? We're going to find out that all but one of them come, okay? And the 2 daughters are at home as well. The 2 daughters are younger than David. David is the youngest of all the kids in his family. Jesse leaves one of his sons at home, and he's apparently watching the sheep, which, by the way, watching the sheep was a woman's job, not a man's job, okay? Not to be racist or to be, not racist, what's the word I'm looking for? Stereotypical? Sexist, thank you. It's one of those things that I'm doing right now. That was a woman's job in Israel, okay? Women were shepherdesses. That's what they did. And if you didn't have women old enough to take care of the sheep, then it was the youngest son's job to do that. But it was not looked upon as a, wow, you're a shepherd. What a cool job. It's like, man, that was your life goal to be a shepherd, huh? Like, you get to clean up poo and, right? So, like, literally, we went to Israel and we would go see 9-year-old little girls with a staff in their hand leading today, currently, 40 sheep throughout the wilderness. And that was their job. 9-year-old little girl, okay? 3rd grader. And that's her job, okay? That's what she does for the family. So it's primarily would have been a woman's job, okay? So Jesse comes. He anoints now this king, or is about to, okay? And he brings his firstborn, okay? Which would have been the most logical choice. Verse 6, Eliab, Jesse's firstborn son, and he says, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Apparently, Eliab was a lot like Saul, firstborn, impressive, looked like a king. Okay? Verse 7, this is God's response, or Samuel's response.
But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance.
Isn't that fascinating? So we're not going to pick another king like Saul. So what do we know immediately about this next king, externally? He's not impressive, right? We're going to find out that David's not ugly, right? He didn't run into the back of a cement truck or anything. But he's not impressive. He's not a head turner when he walks into a room. He just fits in. He blends, okay? So we're not going to pick another dude like that. What are we going to look for? What are the qualities that we're going to pick?
Character.
A good heart, right? We're going to look for godliness in this next king, okay? Fascinating to me that David is an artist and he's a musician. He's not a warrior. He's not a guy that goes to battle. He's not the guy that you would typically think would be a king, right? This guy likes to journal. He likes to draw pictures. He likes to play music. He likes to worship. Not that any of that's bad. He's just not the stereotypical king, right? That was Saul. God says, no. I want a guy that can reflect. I want a guy that can pray. I want a guy that can worship me. So those are great qualities, okay? So lest we trash our musician and artist friends, okay? It's fascinating to me that we would think he's maybe not a natural leader. He's maybe not gregarious. He's maybe not these external things that we would pick. God says, I don't care. I want a guy whose heart is right with me, and those things will come. I'll teach him those things, okay? So he's a fascinating guy, okay? So they go through the list of sons, right? No, 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 no. They get all the way to the end of his sons. In verse 10, Jesse says, seven of his sons passed before Samuel, but Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these, okay? Verse 11, read that.
And Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children?
Which is an odd question. Like, again, how many kids would you have brought? All of them. You got two daughters at home. You got a wife at home. You got a brother at home that can watch the sheep. Bring all your kids, right? He brought the other six just in case Eliab wasn't the guy, but he doesn't bring David. Why? It's an odd question, okay? There remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep. Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes back. So he went and brought him in. He was ruddy, okay, which means red. So he's this pale, red-headed, freckled kid, okay, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance, okay? So good-looking dude, okay? Why are his eyes brought up, by the way? Why are eyes so important in Israel? It's a sign of your heart, okay? So weak in the eyes can mean not beautiful like Rachel and Leah. Leah was weak in the eyes. Okay, that literally meant not real pleasant to look at. The reason they brought up David's eyes is because it's a sign of his soul, right? It's the idea that, man, this is a guy that's, he's right with God. Okay, verse 13, read that. Or end of verse 12 and 13. Ben, redheaded, you need to read this.
And the Lord said, arise and for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward, and Samuel rose up and went to Ramah.
Okay, so we've just anointed our next king, okay? So all ends up well, okay? We still need to answer the question. I think it's important. Why did Jesse not bring every son? Why would you suppose he didn't bring every son? What's that? Cinderella complex, is that what you said? Meaning what? But he brings five or six other kids that are all less than firstborn. Why did he bring all them? If he was so confident it was Eliab, why did he bring the other kids? Probably not if he's at home doing women's work. Right? I mean, that's a humiliating job. That's not something that you aspire to.
Maybe he didn't like David very much.
Maybe he didn't like David. Why would he not like David? Turn to Psalm 51. I'll show you guys something. I want to show you something. You have read this psalm a number of times, but I don't think you've ever read it like this. And this isn't necessarily correct, but maybe not. I don't know, okay? I'm throwing something out there. I wonder if this is why Jesse didn't bring David, okay? I wonder if David, in this psalm, he's about to make a statement, okay? This is after his sin with Bathsheba, okay? So this is fast forward in the kingdom. David's been on the throne. He's 50 years old. We're meeting him right now, and he's a teenager. He's probably 12 or 13 at the most at this point, maybe as young as 8, okay, when we see this occur, okay? It's chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. Okay, he's going to make a statement. Okay, He's confessing his sin with Bathsheba. Be gracious to me, O God. Be loving kindness. Wash me, verse 2, of my iniquity. Cleanse me of my sin. I know my transgressions. Against you I have sinned. So 1 through 4, he's confessing his sin with Bathsheba. Now, verse 5, this is where I want to camp on. Okay, read that. Okay, what is that? When we normally read that, how do we hear those words? There's a theological, shingle that we hang on that. Okay, what do we talk about when we hear that? It's brought forth in sin, and in sin my mother conceived me. Yeah. David's talking about his sin nature, right? Original sin. I came out of the womb, and I was already tainted. What could David be saying right there? Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin, my mother conceived me. How did David come about? Was Jesse his dad? Maybe not. Maybe David's actually saying, in sin, my mother conceived me. My mom slept with another dude who wasn't Jesse, and I'm the result of that. So I am the bastard child. I am at home watching sheep. So when my dad brings out all his favorite sons that are his own, he brings his 7, and I stay home with the sheep. And God says, nope, 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 nope. Samuel, or Jesse, where are the rest of your sons? Do you have any more? Yeah, there's one back home, and he's doing the women's work. He's watching sheep. Well, go get him. Okay. And you can hear the disappointment in Jesse. And he comes, and there it is, right? You're going to see that his brothers all look down upon him, okay, especially the oldest. Probably as the result of them all getting punked and David getting chosen, but Eliab is specifically harsh to David in the future. So I wonder. I don't know. Okay, that could be right. David could be making a theological statement, but it seems quite natural that David could be making a statement about literally how he was brought into this world. Okay, so it would make a lot of sense as to why Jesse didn't pick him. Okay, if God said to me, "You're about to have a queen over Fresno," all 3 of my daughters are showing up. Okay, I don't know which one it is, but if it's one of my 3, they're all coming. I'm not leaving one at home, okay? I'll call one of you guys to house sit the dog or whatever. I'll find a way for the sheep to get watched if that's what it takes, okay? So, there you go. So, next week, we'll go on into David's life and watch his beginnings as the next king of Israel, all right? You guys have a great weekend. Be safe, have fun. We will see you next week.